This episode is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 65 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
You know, it's funny. I actually wish I had that when I was tested.
Oh, totally. So anyway, imagine waking up, right? You pour yourself a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
You log into your brokerage account, and you realize you just lost $50,000 in like 30 seconds.
Ouch. Yeah, that's a bad morning.
A terrible morning.
Yeah.
And not because you picked a bad stock or because the company went bankrupt. It's because you didn't understand the difference between a brokered CD and a regular bank CD, and you just assumed the government had your back.
Which is such a classic mistake.
It really is. So welcome to the deep dive. Today we have a very specific, honestly, very critical mission. We have sitting right in front of us the ultimate dense Series 65 one-page cheat sheet.
And it is dense. It's a wall of text.
Yeah, if you try to just memorize this thing by staring at it, I mean, your eyes are going to glaze over immediately, and you're going to get absolutely slaughtered in the exam room.
Oh, 100%. It's genuinely a recipe for disaster. Because, well, the test writers for this exam, they are not testing your ability to just regurgitate a flashcard.
Right.
They're testing your ability to actually apply the law and the financial math to wildly complex, totally deceptive, real-world scenarios.
They love their deceptive scenarios.
They really do. They will throw in these red herring numbers designed entirely just to distract you. They'll use like slight variations in terminology to lead you right into a trap.
So our goal today is to basically expose every single one of those traps.
Right.
We're taking the what on this cheat sheet, and we're obsessively dissecting the how and the why.
Because when you understand the mechanics, when you actually understand why a rule exists, you don't even have to memorize it. You just know it.
Exactly. You just intuitively get it. And to make sure this actually sticks in your brain, because, you know, dry lectures are the worst, we're not going to talk about abstract, faceless investors today.
No, humans are wired for stories.
Right. For gossip, for watching other people make terrible financial decisions. So we are bringing in a recurring cast of three fictional characters to guide us through this whole financial universe. I want you to picture them in your head right now as you're listening. First, we have Frank, the founder.
Good old Frank.
Yeah, Frank is an ambitious, slightly reckless entrepreneur. He is building a tech business from the ground up. He constantly needs capital, and he moves way too fast.
He's the guy who thinks sleep is for the weak.
Totally.
Yeah.
Next up, we have cautious Kathy. Now, Kathy is a highly risk-averse investor who is fundamentally terrified of losing a single penny of her hard-earned money.
She loves safety. She loves government guarantees. She loves insurance.
Exactly. If an investment doesn't let her sleep soundly at night, she will just walk away, even if it means missing out on, like, a massive return.
She's the one checking her savings account balance 3 times a day.
And finally, we have day trading Dave. Dave is our adrenaline junkie. Picture a guy with like 6 glowing monitors in his basement, completely obsessed with leverage, trading options, finding loopholes, and just swinging for the fences.
Dave is a walking regulatory hazard.
He really is. He frequently walks right into exam traps because he genuinely believes the rules just don't apply to him. Whatever there is a worst case scenario on this exam, Dave is usually the guy standing right in the middle of it.
It's the perfect framework, really. We can take any complex regulation today and just ask, you know, how does this help Frank? How does this protect Kathy? And how does this ultimately put Dave in jail?
Exactly. But before Frank can build his business, or before Kathy can hoard her cash, or Dave can start trading on margin, we have to look at the casino they're all playing in. We have to understand the economic engine.
The big picture stuff.
No.
The macroeconomic environment.
Right. So let's unpack the business cycle first. This is the heartbeat of the entire economy. You've got the trough, expansion, the peak, and contraction. It's just a constant rhythm.
Now, if you watch the financial news, people throw around the word recession whenever the stock market has like one bad week.
Which is so annoying.
It is. But the exam demands the strict mathematical definition. A recession is officially 2 consecutive down quarters of gross domestic product, or GDP.
And a depression.
A depression is 6 consecutive down quarters. But honestly, I mean, who cares about the labels? Why does it actually matter to our characters where we are in that cycle?
Well, it matters because the position in the business cycle acts as a tripwire, right?
Mm-hmm.
It triggers the reactions of the 2 biggest, most powerful players in the game, the Federal Reserve and the federal government.
This is the realm of monetary and fiscal policy.
Yeah, when the economy hits a contraction, the government doesn't just, you know, shrug its shoulders and let everyone go bankrupt. It intervenes massively, and those interventions literally change the price of every single asset Dave and Kathy own.
Let's visualize this. Think of the U.S. economy as a massive, heavy car just driving down the highway. Monetary policy is the Federal Reserve, the Fed, sitting right there in the driver's seat.
They're steering the money supply.
Exactly. They have three main controls at their disposal. They have open market operations, the discount rate, and reserve requirements. That is their gas pedal, their brakes, and their steering wheel.
So let's say we are in a recession. The car is slowing down, right? The Fed slams on the gas. But how do they actually do that?
They engage in open market operations by buying securities from banks. They basically hand the banks fresh cash, which pumps liquidity into the system.
They also lower the discount rate, which is the interest rate the Fed charges banks for short-term loans. By making borrowing cheaper for the bank, the banks lower their own rates.
Which makes it cheaper for Frank, the founder, to go get a business loan to keep his company afloat.
Right. And finally, they can lower the reserve requirement, which is that specific percentage of deposits banks are legally required to just keep locked in the vault. If the Fed lowers that requirement, banks can lend out a much larger chunk of their deposits.
All three of those actions are expansionary. They flood the engine with fuel.
Okay, so the Fed is driving the car. But what about fiscal policy?
Well, if the Fed is driving the car, fiscal policy is Congress and the president basically acting as the road builders. Fiscal policy is purely about spending and taxes.
Right, the politicians.
Yeah, the politicians. So if the economy is in a trough, Congress might run a deficit. They spend more money than they take in through taxes. This is expansionary. They're literally building new roads, funding infrastructure projects, or, you know, sending stimulus checks directly into people's pockets.
Conversely, if the economy is at the peak, it's running way too hot, and inflation is just soaring, they might run a surplus to cool things down.
Right. They raise taxes and cut spending. They put up toll booths and take money out of the economy. That is contractionary.
So we have the car moving. The roads are being built. But what about the weather outside? That's the international currency market. And there's a dynamic here that quietly slaughters amateur investors.
Oh, currency translation. This is huge.
Yeah, a strong U.S. dollar sounds, I don't know, incredibly patriotic and positive.
Mm.
But why does a strong dollar actually eat a U.S. investor's foreign returns alive?
It's all about the mechanics of how that money comes back home. Let's put Dave in this scenario. So Dave takes his strong U.S. dollars and he buys stock in a European tech company.
Right.
That stock trades in Europe, so it's priced in euros. Now let's say Dave is actually right for once. The company crushes its earnings and the stock price goes up 20% in euros. Dave is ecstatic. He clicks sell.
But wait, he doesn't get to spend euros at his local grocery store in Ohio. He has to bring that money home.
Exactly. When Dave converts those euros back into U.S. dollars, he is totally at the mercy of the exchange rate. If the U.S. dollar has gotten significantly stronger relative to the euro while he held that stock, it means the euro has weakened.
Right. So it takes more euros to buy a single U.S. dollar than it did when he started.
Yes. So when Dave swaps his European profits back, those weaker euros buy fewer dollars. The strong dollar effectively shrinks his foreign returns the exact moment they cross the border. It is a silent tax on international gains.
That is wild. The stock can go up 20%, but you can still lose money if the currency just moves against you.
Happens all the time.
Okay, let's zoom in from the macro economy down to analyzing the actual numbers. Cautious Kathy and Day Trading Dave need a mathematical way to evaluate their options. And the absolute backbone of finance here is the time value of money.
TVM. A dollar today is fundamentally worth more than a dollar tomorrow, simply because you can invest the dollar today and earn interest on it.
Right. When we look forward, future value compounds, it grows exponentially. When we look backward, present value discounts, it shrinks future money back to what it's worth in today's terms.
And for a really quick mental math trick, the exam loves a rule of 72.
Oh, that's a classic.
Yeah, it is. You just divide the number 72 by your annual interest rate, and that tells you roughly how many years it will take for your money to double. So if Kathy finds a guaranteed bond paying 6%, 72 divided by 6 is 12, it will take her 12 years to double her money.
But the real meat of the analytical methods, the stuff that actually separates the amateurs from the professionals, is how you evaluate a potential project or a complex investment. We have two heavy hitter tools here, net present value, or NPV, and internal rate of return, or IRR.
Right. NPV gives you a hard dollar amount. It takes all the projected future cash flows an investment will generate, discounts them back to today's value using your required rate of return, and then subtracts the initial cost of the investment.
So if that final number is positive, I mean, even if it's just positive one single dollar, you accept the project.
Exactly. It means the investment is creating absolute wealth beyond your required rate.
And then there's IRR, which gives you a percentage instead of a dollar amount. IRR is essentially the exact mathematical discount rate that makes your NPV perfectly zero. You want an IRR that is higher than your required rate of return, which we call your hurdle rate.
So let's play a game here. Let's put the listener in the hot seat.
Oh, I like this.
Put yourself in Kathy's shoes for a second. Listen closely. Kathy is looking at an incredibly complex investment. Her accountant runs the math and slides a spreadsheet across the desk. The sheet shows the project has a positive net present value of $10,000.
Okay, so NPV is positive.
Right. But the internal rate of return comes in at 7.9%, and her required hurdle rate is 8.0%. So the two metrics are giving her conflicting advice. One says yes, the other says no. Take a second. Which metric should Kathy trust to make her final decision?
Okay, take a beat.
She must trust NPV. Always, always prefer net present value if the two metrics conflict.
But I want to know why. Like, why is IRR the inferior metric in this situation?
Because IRR has a massive baked-in flaw in its underlying algebra. It assumes that all the cash flow you generate along the way can be perfectly reinvested at that exact same internal rate of return.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Let's say Dave finds a crazy real estate flip with an IRR of 40%. The math assumes that when the property kicks off $5,000 in rent next month, Dave can instantly find another investment to park that rent money that also yields exactly 40%.
Which in the real world is completely absurd. You can't just magically recreate your best returns on demand.
Exactly. NPV doesn't make that wildly optimistic reinvestment assumption. NPV tells you exactly how many hard dollars richer you will be in today's purchasing power. It's just a much more realistic measure of absolute wealth creation.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
And let's talk about the concept that really governs everything our characters do, which is risk. The Series 65 exam divides risk into two distinct, highly testable buckets. Systematic risk and unsystematic risk.
This is a foundational distinction. Systematic risks affect the entire system, the entire macroeconomic environment. You absolutely cannot diversify them away.
Right. Does not matter how many different stocks you own. If a systematic risk event happens, your portfolio is taking a hit. And the exam uses a brilliant acronym here.
Yes, PRIME. P-R-I-M-E.
Let's spell that out. P is for purchasing power risk, which is basically just inflation eating your cash. R is for reinvestment risk, which is the danger that interest rates drop, and when your bond matures, you have to reinvest your money at a lower rate.
Right.
R is for interest rate risk, the risk that rates go up, crushing the value of your existing bonds. M is for market risk, the risk that the whole stock market just crashes. And E is for exchange rate or currency risk, which we just talked about with Dave's European stock.
PRIME. These hit everyone. And we measure systematic risk with a metric called beta. A beta of exactly 1.0 means the stock moves exactly in tandem with the broader market.
And on the other side of the coin, we have unsystematic risk.
Right. This is company-specific risk. Credit risk, legal risk, sudden CEO scandals, a factory burning down, a massive product recall. These only affect one specific company or maybe one specific sector.
So let's look at day trading Dave again. Dave reads a blog post on Reddit about risk. He panics and he decides he wants to be perfectly 100% safe.
Good luck with that.
Right. So he logs into his account and buys 100 different tech stocks. He diversifies across software, hardware, semiconductors, AI, everything. He has his massive 100 stock portfolio. He leans back in his chair and thinks he is completely invincible. Is he?
He is not even close to invincible. Dave just successfully eliminated his unsystematic risk. If one of those 100 tech companies hires a terrible CEO and goes bankrupt, well, the other 99 stocks balance it out. The portfolio barely feels it.
Right.
But Dave has done absolutely nothing to protect himself from systematic risk. If the Federal Reserve unexpectedly hikes interest rates by 2% tomorrow, all 100 of those tech stocks are going down simultaneously. He is fully exposed to market risk and interest rate risk.
So how does Dave actually fix that? If buying 100 stocks doesn't work, what does?
The only way to mitigate systematic risk is through hedging, like buying protective options, or through true asset allocation. That means adding completely non-correlated asset classes to the portfolio. He needs to add government bonds, real estate, commodities.
Diversification within the exact same asset class only cures unsystematic risk.
Exactly. And that is a trap the exam writers absolutely love to set. They will describe a beautifully diversified portfolio of 50 blue chip stocks and ask what risk the investor is still exposed to. The answer is always systematic risk or market risk.
Okay, before Frank the founder can convince Dave to invest in his tech startup, Frank has to show Dave the math behind his business. Financial reporting, we have the big three statements. First, the balance sheet.
I like to think of this one as a point in time snapshot.
Yeah, it's the financial selfie of the company, taken right at midnight on December 31st. And it balances because it rests on the ultimate accounting identity. Assets equal liabilities plus owner's equity. What the company owns equals what it owes plus what actually belongs to the shareholders.
Then you have the income statement. Unlike the balance sheet, the income statement covers a period of time, like a full calendar year. It tells a story.
Right. It starts with revenue at the top line, all the money coming in the door, and subtracts expenses as you work your way down to net income at the bottom line. But here is the critical analytical piece that traps so many investors. Public companies use accrual accounting.
Yes, this is so important.
Wait, let me make sure I'm picturing this correctly. Accrual accounting means you record the revenue when the economic event happens, not when the cash actually hits your hands.
Okay. Right?
So Frank could ship $1 million worth of software to a client in December on 90-day payment terms. His income statement for the year looks amazing. He shows $1 million in new revenue and huge net income.
Exactly. But if you look at Frank's actual bank account on December 31st, it's completely empty. The client hasn't paid him yet. Strong net income on an income statement can absolutely mask weak or even negative cash flow.
Which brings us to the third statement, the statement of cash flows, which is arguably the most important for the actual day-to-day survival of the business. It sorts all cash activity into three buckets: operating, investing, and financing.
And to find operating cash flow, you start with that net income number we just talked about, and you have to adjust it. You add back non-cash expenses like depreciation.
This confuses a lot of people. Depreciation lowers Frank's net income for tax purposes. It reflects the wear and tear on his factory equipment. But Frank didn't actually write a physical check to an entity called depreciation.
Right, that cash never left the business. So on the cash flow statement, we add that depreciation right back to the net income to find out how much actual cash the business generated.
Let's flag a specific exam trap on cash flows while we're here. Dividends. This is purely a definitional trap. If Frank's company pays a cash dividend out to its shareholders, what kind of activity is that?
It is considered a financing activity. He is financing his relationship with his owners, distributing the profits of the enterprise.
But, and here's the twist, if Frank's company took some excess cash, invested it in shares of Apple, and Frank's company receives a dividend from Apple, that is considered an operating activity under standard U.S. accounting rules.
Same thing with interest. If Frank pays interest on a bank loan, that cash outflow is classified as an operating activity. That asymmetry dividends paid is financing. Dividends received and interest paid or operating is highly, highly testable.
So good to know. Now let's imagine the absolute worst case scenario. Frank gets overly ambitious, he expands too fast, he runs out of cash, and the business completely fails. It goes into Chapter 7 liquidation.
Oh man, the death of the company.
Yeah, there is a very strict legal priority of who gets paid from whatever cash is generated from selling off the office chairs and the laptops. And the golden rule is debt always beats equity.
The line forms at the courthouse, and it is strictly enforced. The secured creditors are at the very front of the line. If a bank holds a mortgage on Frank's building, they get the building.
Right.
Next are the general unsecured creditors, the vendors who sold him supplies on credit, then subordinated debt holders. Only after every single penny of debt is paid off do we cross over into the equity side.
And even within equity, there's a hierarchy. Preferred stockholders are next in line.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, standing dead last, just holding an empty bag, is the common stockholder.
Which is day trading Dave. Dave is holding the common stock, so he gets whatever pennies are left over at the absolute end, which in a bankruptcy is almost always zero.
But this hierarchy brings up a core undeniable financial truth. Higher priority in liquidation means greater safety. And greater safety mathematically must mean lower return.
Dave bought the common stock. He took the absolute maximum risk of being last in line, so he demanded the highest potential upside if the company succeeded. Cautious Kathy bought the secured debt. She took the least risk, so she accepts the lowest yield.
which perfectly transitions us away from the foundation and into the actual vehicles our characters are using. Let's look at the menus.
Yeah, the actual investments.
Right. Frank needs capital. He can either borrow it from cautious Kathy that's fixed income or bonds. Or he could sell a piece of his ownership to day trading Dave. That's equities or stock. Let's start with Kathy's absolute favorite category, cash and cash equivalents.
These instruments are built entirely to preserve principal. Demand deposits, savings accounts, certificates of deposit. Now, Kathy loves the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. It lets her sleep at night.
But the exam tests the limits of this coverage relentlessly.
Oh, they do. The rule is FDIC covers up to $250,000 per depositor, per insured bank, per ownership category.
So I want you to put your exam hat on and listen to this scenario. Let's say Kathy doesn't go to her local bank. Instead, she logs into her brokerage account and buys a brokered CD, a certificate of deposit issued by a bank, but traded on the secondary market. She buys $250,000 worth.
Okay.
Suddenly, interest rates spike in the broader economy. Because new CDs are offering higher rates, the secondary market value of her existing lower rate CD drops to $200,000. She logs in and sees she's down 50 grand. Will the FDIC step in and write her a check to cover that $50,000 market loss? Take a second to think about it.
The answer is absolutely, unequivocally not.
This is such a vital distinction. FDIC insurance protects against bank failure. It acts as a backstop if the bank itself goes bankrupt and literally does not have the money to hand back to you.
Right. It does not protect against market risk, interest rate risk, or bad timing. If the issuing bank goes under, Kathy gets her $250,000 back from the FDIC. But if the bank is perfectly healthy and she just wants to sell her CD early on the secondary market and the market price has dropped due to interest rates, she eats that loss completely.
The FDIC does not care about your market fluctuations.
Not even a little bit.
Other cash equivalents include commercial paper. This is a very specific term. Commercial paper is just a short-term, unsecured corporate IOU. Frank needs cash to make payroll next week, so he issues commercial paper.
The magic number for the exam here is 270 days. If the commercial paper matures in 270 days or less, it is completely exempt from the incredibly expensive, time-consuming SEC registration process.
Then we have treasury bills, or T-bills. These are government-backed, completely free of default risk, and their interest is exempt from state and local taxes, though you still pay federal tax.
And finally, money market mutual funds. These funds take investor cash and buy all the short-term stuff we just mentioned. They attempt to maintain a net asset value, an NAV, of exactly $1 per share.
But remember that $1 is a target, not a legal guarantee. Mm-hmm. In times of extreme financial crisis, they can break the buck and drop below a dollar, though it is incredibly rare.
Yeah, usually they stay right at a buck.
Now let's move slightly up the risk curve into true fixed income, bonds. When you buy a bond, you are acting as the lender. Let's look at who is doing the borrowing. The U.S. Treasury issues bonds, and as we said, they carry zero default risk. Then we have agency bonds. This is where the exam gets incredibly nitpicky.
It really does. There are several government-sponsored agencies that issue debt to fund mortgages in agriculture. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Ginnie Mae. But here is the trivia fact that the exam treats as gospel. Only Ginnie Mae, the Government National Mortgage Association, carries the direct, explicit, full faith and credit backing of the United States government.
So the others are just sponsored.
Right. If things get really bad, the government probably bails out Fannie and Freddie, but they are legally obligated to bail out Ginnie Mae.
Good to know. Okay, municipal bonds are fascinating because they're entirely driven by the tax angle. Municipalities, cities, states, counties, they issue bonds to build schools and fix sewers. The interest you earn on a muni bond is federally tax exempt. But do not fall for this trap. Their capital gains are still fully taxable.
Let me explain that distinction because it catches a lot of people.
Go for it.
If Kathy buys a municipal bond, the semi-annual interest checks she receives are free from federal income tax. However, if she buys a municipal bond in the secondary market at a discount, say she pays $900 for a bond with a $1,000 face value and she holds it to maturity, she just made a $100 profit.
That $100 is a capital gain, and the IRS will absolutely tax it. The tax exemption only applies to the interest payments, not to price appreciation.
Exactly. And munis come in two distinct flavors. General obligation bonds, or GOs, are backed by the full taxing power of the town. Because they involve taxpayer money, they usually require voter approval on a ballot.
Revenue bonds are different. They are backed purely by the revenue generated by the specific project. They are funding the tolls from a new bridge or the patient fees from a new hospital. If nobody drives over the bridge, the bond defaults. The taxpayers are not on the hook.
But the most important concept in fixed income, the physical law of gravity that governs everything Dave and Kathy do in the bond market, is the bond seesaw. Price and yield move in opposite directions. Always. Unconditionally.
If interest rates in the broader market go up, the price of existing bonds goes down.
It's that simple.
Okay, I want to spend some time here because this is heavily tested. Let's visualize this. I want you to picture a physical stepladder leaning against a wall. We are going to map the different yields a bond produces onto the rungs of this ladder. Let's say Frank issues a bond, but interest rates in the market instantly go up.
So Frank's bond is now paying a lower rate than new bonds, so nobody wants it.
Right. To sell it, Frank has to offer it a discount. He sells it for less than its $1,000 par value.
So for a discount bond, the yields physically climb up the rungs of the ladder. On the bottom rung, you have the nominal yield, also known as the coupon rate. That is the fixed percentage printed on the physical bond certificate. It never changes.
Step up one rung, and you have the current yield, which is the annual interest divided by the discounted market price.
Step up again, and you have the yield to maturity, which factors in the fact that Frank will eventually pay you the full $1,000 par value, giving you a built-in capital gain.
And at the very top rung of the ladder is the yield to call, which assumes Frank pays you back early, accelerating that capital gain. So for a discount bond, from bottom to top, it's nominal current YPM YTC.
But what if interest rates in the market crash? Now Frank's bond is paying a relatively high rate. Everyone wants it. The price gets bid up to a premium above par value. What happens to our ladder?
The entire ladder tips completely upside down. The nominal yield is now at the very top. Then you step down to current yield, step down again to yield to maturity, and at the absolute bottom rung, you find the yield to call.
And why does this ladder analogy actually matter for the exam? Because of an unbreakable rule concerning client disclosure. A broker must always quote the investor, the yield to worst, the lowest possible yield they could theoretically receive.
So look at our ladders. On a premium bond, the yield to call is at the very bottom. It is the yield to worst. On a discount bond, the yield to maturity is the lowest rung on the expected timeline. It is the yield to worst.
If you can visualize that ladder flipping back and forth, you will nail every bond math question without touching a calculator.
Speaking of interest rate movements, we have to talk about duration. Duration is a complex metric, but intuitively, it is simply a measure of a bond's sensitivity to interest rate changes. It is basically asking, how long is my money held hostage by this investment?
The longer your money is held hostage, the more exposed you are to interest rate swings.
So what specific factors make duration go up, making the bond more volatile and riskier?
Three variables increase duration: a longer maturity, a lower coupon rate, and a lower overall yield. Think about it. If you buy a 30-year bond paying a tiny 1% coupon, your principal is locked up for three decades, and you are receiving almost no cash flow along the way to offset your risk.
That bond has a massive duration. If interest rates twitch even slightly, the price of that 30-year 1% bond will swing violently.
Exactly.
Hold on. If a low coupon increases duration, what happens if we take it to the extreme? What about a zero coupon bond? It pays no interest at all until the very end.
A zero coupon bond has the highest possible duration for its time frame. In fact, its duration is exactly equal to its maturity in years. Since there are zero cash flows along the way to offset your risk, a 10-year zero coupon bond has a duration of exactly 10. It is perfectly exposed to interest rate volatility.
All right, so Frank has borrowed enough from Kathy in the bond market. Now he wants to raise serious capital by selling equity to day trading Dave. Common stock versus preferred stock.
Common stock is true ownership. Dave gets voting rights. He has unlimited upside if Frank's tech company becomes the next Google. But as we discussed, he has a residual claim. He's last in line in a bankruptcy.
And he only gets a dividend if Frank's board of directors actually meets and formally declares one. Frank is under no legal obligation to pay common dividends.
Right. Preferred stock, on the other hand, is a strange hybrid vehicle. It is technically equity, but it acts like debt. It pays a fixed, stated dividend. It has priority over common stock in liquidation, but it usually comes with absolutely no voting rights.
And because its dividend is fixed, its price is highly sensitive to interest rate changes, just like a bond.
Yep.
Let's do a direct side-by-side comparison on voting rights for common stock, because the exam loves the math here. Cumulative voting versus statutory voting. Let's create a scenario. Frank's board of directors has three open seats. Dave owns 100 shares of the company. A massive institutional investor owns 200 shares.
Under statutory voting, which is the standard, Dave can cast his 100 votes for a candidate for seat A, 100 for seat B and 100 for seat C. The institutional investor votes their 200 shares for their own candidates for A, B, and C.
The institution wins every single seat. Statutory voting heavily favors the majority shareholder, who can just steamroll Dave across the board.
But under cumulative voting, Dave can pool his power. He has 300 total votes across the three seats. Cumulative voting allows him to take all 300 votes and dump them entirely onto one single candidate for seat A.
The institution has 600 total votes, but if he tried to spread them across all three seats to maintain total control, they only have 200 votes per seat. Dave's 300 beats their 200. Dave wins seat A.
He gets a voice on the board. Cumulative voting is the minority shareholder's absolute best friend.
Once Dave is looking at buying into a company, how does he actually figure out what a share is worth? There are two completely different, somewhat warring schools of thought here. Fundamental analysis versus technical analysis.
Cautious Kathy is a hardcore fundamental analyst. She pores over the balance sheets. She looks at price-to-earnings ratios, price-to-book ratios. She is trying to calculate the true intrinsic value of the business.
One of her favorite tools is the dividend discount model. This model attempts to figure out what a stock is worth today by calculating the present value of all the future dividends the company will ever pay.
And if she assumes the company will increase its dividends steadily over time, she uses a variation called the Gordon Growth Model. The Gordon Growth Model takes the expected dividend next year and divides it by the required rate of return minus the expected growth rate of the dividend.
It basically treats the stock like a perpetual bond that pays a slightly higher coupon every year. Kathy believes that if the current stock price is lower than the value the model spits out, the stock is undervalued and she should buy it.
Day trading Dave thinks Kathy is wasting her time. He doesn't care about the balance sheet or the Gordon Growth Model. He doesn't even know what Frank's company actually sells.
Dave is a technical analyst. He looks purely at charts, price movements, trading volume, moving averages, and support and resistance levels. He believes that everything there is to know about a company, all the fundamentals, all the rumors, all the insider trading, is instantly reflected in the stock's price chart.
So he doesn't analyze the business. He analyzes the psychology of the other traders. He trades the momentum.
Now let's look at the mechanics of how Frank actually gets this stock to Dave in the first place. The IPO, the initial public offering. This entire process happens in the primary market, meaning the money Dave pays goes directly to Frank's company to fund operations, not to another investor.
To do this, Frank must file a massive registration statement, an S-1, with the SEC.
Once he files, he enters what is known as the cooling off period. This is a strict 20-day minimum period where the SEC reviews the paperwork to ensure Frank isn't lying about his financials.
During this 20-day cooling off period, Frank and his Wall Street underwriters can do a few things, but they are heavily restricted. They can hand out a preliminary prospectus. We call this a red herring because it literally has a red warning printed on the cover stating that the registration isn't effective yet.
They can go on a roadshow and collect indications of interest from big buyers. But here is the absolute law. No money can change hands, and no sales can be finalized. None.
And then the 20 days are up. The SEC has reviewed the paperwork, they found no obvious lies, and they declare the registration effective. What happens? Does the SEC publicly approve Frank's company as a good investment?
Never. The SEC never approves a security. They do not care if Frank's business model is terrible or if his product is a scam, as long as he honestly disclosed all the risks in the paperwork.
The SEC only clears the security for sale based on the adequacy and completeness of the disclosures. To print on a brochure or to tell a client that the SEC approved an investment is a criminal offense under federal law.
The underwriters helping Frank take his company public can use two different approaches. A firm commitment underwriting, where the investment bank buys all the shares from Frank directly, putting their own capital at risk, and then tries to resell them to the public. They act as a principal.
Or a best efforts underwriting, where the bank just acts as an agent, trying their best to sell the shares for a commission, and whatever is unsold just goes back to Frank.
We are now crossing the border into Section 3, the Wild West, advanced securities and alternative investments. Day trading Dave is completely bored with plain old stocks and bond. He wants leverage. He wants complex pooling strategies. He wants derivatives.
Oh, this is Dave's playground. Let's start with pooled investments, governed heavily by the Investment Company Act of 1940. This act regulates companies that pool money from thousands of investors to buy a portfolio of securities.
The exam requires you to intimately know the difference between the two main types, open-end funds, which we commonly call mutual funds, versus closed-end funds. Let's do a direct comparison.
Open-end mutual funds are continuous. They continuously issue brand new shares to anyone who wants to buy, and they will redeem or buy back shares from anyone who wants to sell. You transact directly with the fund itself.
And you always transact at the net asset value, the NAV. But here is the trick that frustrates day traders. It uses forward pricing.
That's right. If Dave puts in a buy order for a mutual fund at 10 a.m., he has absolutely no idea what price he is going to pay. The fund waits until the stock market closes at 4 p.m., tallies up the value of all the assets in the portfolio, calculates the end-of-day NAV, and that is the price Dave gets.
Mutual funds are legally required to send you your money within 7 days if you redeem. And critically, because mutual funds are continuously issuing new shares, they are legally considered new issues under the Securities Act of 1933.
Therefore, they must be sold with a prospectus, they cannot be bought on margin, and they cannot be sold short.
Closed-end funds operate entirely differently. They do an IPO, they issue a fixed, specific number of shares to the public exactly once. After that IPO, the window closes.
If Dave wants to buy a share, he doesn't go to the fund. He goes to the stock exchange and buys it from Kathy, who is selling hers. Because closed-end shares trade on the open market all day long, their price is not determined by the NAV. It is determined entirely by supply and demand.
Which means a closed-end fund can trade at a premium above its NAV or a massive discount below its NAV. And because they are just regular shares trading on a secondary exchange, you absolutely can buy them on margin and you can absolutely short them.
When you're looking at mutual funds, you need to understand how the fees work. There is a massive exam trap regarding expense ratios and sales loads. The expense ratio is the ongoing annual cost of running the fund. It includes the portfolio manager salary, the administrative costs, and the 12b1 fees.
Let's pause on the 12b1 fee because it's controversial. A 12b1 fee is a distribution and marketing fee. The fund is literally using a percentage of your invested money to pay for advertising and broker commissions to attract new investors to the fund. It actively drags down your long-term return.
But here is the trap. The expense ratio never includes the sales load. The sales load is a completely separate commission you pay to the broker who sold you the fund. And those loads come in different classes.
Class A shares have a front-end load. You pay the commission right off the top when you buy in. They're best for large investments with long time horizons, because they usually offer breakpoints, volume discounts. If you invest $100,000, your commission percentage drops.
Class B shares have a back-end load, or a contingent deferred sales charge. You pay nothing up front, but if you sell the fund within the first few years, you get hit with a massive fee. That fee declines every year you hold it, and eventually Class B shares automatically convert into Class A shares.
Class C shares have a level load. You pay a high ongoing 12b1 fee forever. They never convert. They are generally only suitable for short-term holds where you want to avoid a front-end or back-end commission, but they will bleed you dry over the long term.
Okay, let's escalate Dave's risk profile even further. Derivatives, options, and futures. A derivative is exactly what it sounds like. It has no intrinsic value of its own. It derives its value entirely from the price of an underlying asset, like a stock or a barrel of oil.
Options give you a right. A call option is the right to buy 100 shares of a stock at a specific strike price. A put option is the right to sell 100 shares at a specific strike price.
Think about the two parties involved in an options contract. The buyer of the option pays a cash premium and holds the right. They are in control. The writer or seller of the option collects that premium, but they take on a strict obligation.
Right. If Dave buys a call, he has the right to buy the stock. If Kathy sells a call, she collects Dave's premium, but she is now legally obligated to sell the stock to Dave if he decides to exercise his right.
So what exactly makes up that premium Dave pays? If an option costs $5, where does that number come from? It is made up of two distinct pieces, intrinsic value and time value.
Intrinsic value is the actual hard economic value if the option were exercised right this exact second. Let's say Dave holds a call option with a strike price of $50, giving him the right to buy the stock at $50.
If the stock is currently trading in the market at $60, Dave's option has $10 of intrinsic value. He could exercise the option, buy at $50, instantly sell in the market at $60, and pocket $10. The option is in the money.
But what if the stock is trading at $40? The right to buy a $40 stock for $50 is utterly worthless.
Exactly. In that case, the option is out of the money, and the intrinsic value is mathematically zero. Intrinsic value can never, ever be negative. You just wouldn't exercise the option. So if that out-of-the-money option still costs $2 to buy, what are you paying for?
You're paying entirely for time value. You're paying for the hope, the probability, that before the option expires next month, the stock might surge above $50 and become profitable.
And here is the physical reality of options trading. As the calendar moves forward, time value evaporates. Every single day, the option is worth a little bit less just because time is passing. Time decay always, always favors the seller of the option. The clock is the enemy of the buyer.
Which brings us to how actual, prudent investment advisors use these tools. We generally don't use them for wild speculation like Dave. We use them for hedging.
Hmm.
For insurance, there are two core strategies the exam will test. The first is the protective put.
Picture Kathy. She owns 100 shares of Frank's Tech stock, which is trading at $100. She's up a lot of money, but she is terrified the company might miss earnings next week and the stock might crash to $50. So she buys a put option with a strike price of $90. She pays a small premium.
What did she just do? She bought homeowners insurance. If the stock drops to $50, Kathy doesn't care. She has the contractual right to force someone to buy her shares at $90. She keeps her unlimited upside if the stock goes to $200, but she has strictly capped her downside risk.
The second strategy is the covered call. Let's say Kathy owns the stock and she wants to generate some extra income. She acts as the insurance company. She sells a call option with a strike price of $110 to Dave, and she collects his premium. She gets cash in her pocket today.
But what is the trade-off? She has capped her upside. If Frank's stock rockets to $150, Kathy doesn't get to participate in that joy. She is legally obligated to sell her shares to Dave for $110. She traded away her maximum upside for guaranteed income today.
Let's talk about the dark side of options. I want you to listen very carefully to this setup. Dave wants to make money, but he doesn't own any stock. So he writes a naked call option.
Oh boy.
He simply logs in and sells the right to buy Frank's stock at $50, collecting a premium from the buyer. But Dave doesn't actually own the shares to deliver if things go wrong. Take a second. What is Dave's maximum potential loss in this scenario?
His maximum loss is theoretically unlimited. Infinity.
Exactly. A stock's price can mathematically go down to zero, but it can theoretically rise to infinity. If Dave sold a naked call with a strike of $50 and the company cures cancer and the stock rockets to $10,000 a share, Dave is in deep trouble.
The option buyer will exercise their right to buy the stock at $50. Dave is now legally obligated to go into the open market, buy the stock with his own cash for $10,000, and immediately hand it over to the buyer for $50. He is ruined. Naked call writing is the riskiest, most reckless strategy in all of finance.
Dave loves risk, so let's introduce him to alternative investments, specifically limited partnerships or LPs. These are direct participation programs. They are usually real estate or oil and gas ventures. They pass income, gains, and crucial tax losses directly through to the individual investors on a tax form called a K-1.
But they are incredibly illiquid. You lock your money up for 5 to 10 years, and there is no secondary market to sell your shares if you get bored.
The legal structure of an LP is the main testable point. There must be at least one general partner and one limited partner. The general partner is the boss. They run the day-to-day operations, they make the investment decisions, and because they are in charge, they carry unlimited personal liability.
If the LP gets sued, the general partner can lose their own house. The limited partners, the investors like Dave, have limited liability. The most Dave can lose is his initial investment.
But there is a massive catch. Dave gets bored easily. Let's say he invests in a real estate LP and he drives by the construction site and starts yelling at the contractors, telling them what color to paint the walls, basically acting like a boss. What happens?
Dave just pierced his own liability shield. If a limited partner takes an active role in the day-to-day management of the business, they legally forfeit their limited liability status. They become treated as a general partner, and their personal assets are now completely exposed to the partnership's debts.
What about leveraged and inverse ETFs? Dave absolutely loves these. He finds a 3x bull ETF tracking the S&P 500. He thinks, well, the market always goes up over the long term, so I'll just buy this 3x ETF, hold it for 10 years, and get rich 3 times faster.
Why is this a catastrophic idea? Why can't Dave buy and hold a leveraged ETF?
Because of the math of compounding decay. Leveraged ETFs use complex derivatives to achieve their multiple, and their mandate is to track the daily return of the index. They are required to reset their exposure at the end of every single trading session.
If Dave puts $100 in and the index drops 10% today, the 3X ETF drops 30%. Dave is down to $70.
The next day, the index rebounds 11.1% to get back to even. The 3X ETF goes up 33.3%. But 33.3% of Dave's remaining $70 is only 23 market. So Dave's account is at $93, even though the underlying index is perfectly flat.
The constant daily resetting, especially in a choppy market, creates a mathematical drag that slowly grinds the value down to nothing. Over any period longer than a single day, a leveraged ETF will wildly disconnect from its stated objective. It is strictly a tactical, intraday, day trading weapon. It is not a buy and hold investment.
Let's touch on crypto real quick. The exam has updated to include digital assets. Is Bitcoin a security under SEC jurisdiction? No. The exam currently considers Bitcoin a commodity.
Why? Because it fails the final prong of the Howey test. It does not rely on the managerial efforts of others. There is no CEO of Bitcoin. There is no central board of directors. Therefore, it falls under the jurisdiction of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC, not the SEC.
However, the IRS doesn't care what you call it. They just want their cut. The exam is very clear on crypto taxation. All digital asset swaps are treated as taxable property events.
If Dave buys Bitcoin, holds it, and then directly trades that Bitcoin to buy Ethereum, he did not just do a currency swap, he sold property. He owes capital gains taxes on any appreciation of the Bitcoin at the exact moment he made the swap, even though he never converted it back into US dollars.
Let's finish this wild section with insurance-based products. If you are taking the Series 65, there is a single word you need to hunt for in any insurance question. Variable. Variable annuities, variable life insurance. What does that word mean?
If you see the word variable, it means the client's money is not held by the insurance company. It is placed into a separate, segregated account and invested directly into the stock market. Because it's in the market, the payout will fluctuate. It is variable.
Crucially, this means the client bears the investment risk, not the insurance company. If the market crashes, the client's account value crashes.
And because the client bears the risk, variable products are legally defined as securities. They fall under SEC and state securities regulation. They must be sold with a massive prospectus, and the agent selling them must hold both a state insurance license and a securities license.
Contrast that with fixed annuities. In a fixed annuity, the client's money goes into the insurance company's massive general account. The insurance company promises to pay the client a fixed 4% return.
If the insurance company invests poorly and only makes 2%, they still have to pay the client 4%. The insurer bears all the risk. Because the insurer bears the risk, a fixed annuity is purely an insurance product. It is not a security. You do not need a securities license to sell it.
Watch out for the tax trap on annuities, especially when taking money out early. Let's say Dave puts $100,000 into an annuity. It grows to $150,000. Dave wants to buy a boat, so he withdraws $20,000 during the accumulation phase.
The IRS dictates that withdrawals are treated on a LIFO basis, last in, first out. That means the IRS assumes the money Dave pulled out is entirely composed of his recent gains, not his original principal.
And those gains are taxed as ordinary income at his highest tax bracket, never at the lower capital gains rate. Even worse, if Dave pulls that money out before he reaches age 59 and a half, the IRS slaps him with an additional 10% early withdrawal penalty on top of the income tax. It is a brutal hit.
Contrast that with life insurance, where the actual death benefit passes to the beneficiaries completely, 100% income tax free.
Moving into section 4, managing the clients. Profiles, accounts, and taxes. This is where we stop looking at the products and start looking at the people. We are now stepping into the shoes of the investment advisor.
Frank, Kathy, and Dave are sitting in our reception area. We have to set them up properly without violating any fiduciary duties. Let's start with Frank. Frank needs to formally structure his new tech business. What are his options?
He has several. A sole proprietorship is the easiest. He just starts doing business, but it offers absolutely zero liability protection. If Frank's software accidentally deletes a client's database and he gets sued, the client can take Frank's personal house and his personal bank account.
If he wants a shield between his business and his personal life, he needs to form an entity. He could do an LLC or an S Corp. Both offer limited liability protection. The most he can lose is what he put into the business.
And both offer pass-through taxation. The business entity itself doesn't pay a corporate tax. The profits simply pass through to Frank's personal 1040 tax return.
But an S-Corp has very strict legal limits. An S-Corp is capped at a maximum of 100 shareholders. All shareholders must be U.S. citizens or resident aliens. No foreign investors allowed. And an S-Corp can only issue one single class of stock. You cannot have common and preferred shares.
If Frank wants to raise money from 500 different investors, including foreign venture capital firms, and he wants to issue preferred stock to his angel investors, he is forced to form a C corporation. A C corp is a massive, immortal legal entity. It offers maximum liability protection and infinite scaling.
But it suffers from the dreaded double taxation. The C Corp pays a corporate tax on its profits, and then if it distributes whatever is left to Frank as a dividend, Frank pays personal tax on that dividend. The money is taxed twice.
Now Kathy walks into our office. She wants to set up a trust to protect her assets and pass them to her heirs. She asks us the difference between a revocable trust and an irrevocable trust.
A revocable trust is exactly what it sounds like. Kathy sets it up, puts her house and brokerage account in it, but she retains the power to revoke the trust, change the terms, or take the assets back whenever she wants.
The main benefit is that when she dies, the assets bypass the slow, public, expensive process of probate court and go straight to her heirs. However, because she maintained total control while she was alive, the IRS says she still essentially owned those assets. Therefore, the value of the trust is fully included in her taxable estate when she dies.
An irrevocable trust is a true permanent surrender. Once Kathy puts the assets in, she can never take them back. She can't change the beneficiaries. She gives up all control.
Because she surrendered control, those assets are completely removed from her taxable estate, potentially saving her heirs a fortune in estate taxes, and they are generally shielded from her personal creditors, but it requires extreme commitment.
Before we invest a single dime for any of these characters, we must build a client profile. We document this in a formal document called the Investment Policy Statement, or IPS. We look at their current financial situation, their risk tolerance, their time horizon, and their liquidity needs.
The absolute golden rule of client profiling, and a heavily tested concept, is how to handle conflicts between what a client wants and what they actually need. The rule is the most restrictive factor always governs the decision.
Let's apply that directly to Dave. Dave sits across from us. He says he wants maximum aggression, 100% options trading, zero bonds. He is young, and his psychological risk willingness is sky high. He loves risk.
But as his fiduciary, we look at his actual financials. He just got fired from his job, he has zero emergency savings, and his wife is having twins next month. Mathematically, his risk capacity, his actual financial ability to absorb a loss without going bankrupt, is zero.
Risk capacity objectively overrides psychological willingness. We are legally required to recommend a highly conservative liquid portfolio, regardless of what Dave's ego demands.
Let's look at special account types. Frank wants to start saving for his newborn daughter's college tuition. He is comparing a 529 plan and a Coverdell education savings account. Both allow his investments to grow tax-deferred, and both allow entirely tax-free withdrawals as long as the money is spent on qualified education expenses. But they have incredibly distinct differences.
A 529 plan is incredibly flexible. They have massive six-figure state contribution limits. There are absolutely zero income limits for Frank. Even if he makes $10 million a year, he can contribute.
And critically, Frank, as the account owner, maintains total control of the money forever. If his daughter turns 18 and decides to join a band instead of going to college, Frank can easily change the beneficiary to his younger son, to a niece, or even to himself if he wants to take a continuing education class. The money doesn't belong to the daughter until it is spent on her.
A Coverdell ESA, on the other hand, is highly restrictive and almost obsolete. It hard caps contributions at just $2,000 per year per child. And if Frank is highly successful and his income crosses a certain threshold, he's legally barred from contributing to a Coverdell at all.
What if Frank just wants to give money to his daughter, not necessarily for college? He looks at custodial accounts, specifically UGMA and UTMA accounts. This is where we need to warn him about a major trap. UGMA and UTMA accounts represent an irrevocable permanent gift to a minor.
Frank acts as the custodian and manages the investments, but the money legally and irreversibly belongs to the child the moment it is deposited.
And the trap springs shut when the child reaches the age of majority, which is usually 18 or 21, depending on the specific state law. On that day, the child takes full, unrestricted legal control of the assets. Frank has no say.
If his 18-year-old daughter wants to take the $100,000 Frank saved and buy a Porsche instead of paying tuition, Frank cannot stop her. Furthermore, because the assets legally belong to the child, not the parent, they are weighted heavily against the student when applying for federal financial aid.
Let's talk about how adult accounts are actually titled, specifically for married couples or business partners. The exam tests the difference between joint tenants with a right of survivorship, or JTWROS, and tenants in common, or TEC.
If Dave and his wife open a JTWROS account, they both own 100% of the undivided account. If Dave gets hit by a bus and dies, his share of the account automatically and instantly passes to his surviving wife. It completely skips the probate process. It doesn't matter what Dave's will says. The account title governs.
But tenants in common, TIC, is completely different. Let's say Frank and his business partner open a TIC account to hold company funds, and they split ownership 60-40. If Frank dies, his 60% share does not automatically go to his business partner.
Frank's share drops directly into his personal estate. It will be distributed according to his will. It will go through the slow public probate court process, and it will be subject to estate taxes. Thies does not avoid probate.
Taxes. Holding periods drive everything in portfolio management. If Dave buys a stock and sells it 6 months later for a profit, he has a short-term capital gain. The IRS treats that gain exactly like salary. It is taxed as ordinary income at his highest marginal tax bracket.
If he has the discipline to hold that stock for exactly 1 year and 1 day, it crosses the magic threshold into long-term capital gains territory. He now gets the preferential lower capital gains tax rates of 0, 15, or 20%, depending on his income.
But Dave hates paying taxes, so he tries to get clever with his losses. He holds a stock that is currently down $5,000. He decides to sell it on December 15th to harvest the loss so he can deduct it against his gains and lower his tax bill for the year. But he actually still believes in the company long term, so he buys the exact same stock back 5 days later on December 20th. This triggers one of the most famous traps in the tax code, the wash sale rule.
The IRS will not allow you to generate a fake loss just for tax purposes while maintaining your exact same economic position. If you sell a security at a loss and you buy a substantially identical security within 30 days before or 30 days after the sale, the IRS disallows the loss for current tax purposes.
But the loss isn't permanently vaporized, it is deferred. The disallowed loss is mathematically added to the cost basis of the newly purchased shares. So Dave's new shares have an artificially high cost basis. He won't get to claim the tax benefit of that loss until he finally permanently sells those new shares and stays away from the stock for at least 31 days.
Let's pivot to retirement plans.
Yeah.
The absolute classics. The traditional IRA versus the Roth IRA. A traditional IRA is a deal you make with the government to defer your taxes. You put money in today, and you might get an upfront tax deduction, lowering your current tax bill. The money grows completely tax-deferred for decades. But when you are old and you take the money out in retirement, the IRS takes their cut. Every single penny you withdraw is taxed as ordinary income.
A Roth IRA is the exact opposite architecture. You fund it with after-tax dollars today, you get absolutely no upfront tax deduction. But the magic happens later. The money grows completely tax-free, and if you follow the rules, meaning you are over 59 and a half and the account has been open for 5 years, qualified distributions in retirement are entirely 100% tax-free. And as a massive bonus for estate planning, Roth IRAs never force you to take required minimum distributions or RMDs during your lifetime. You can let the money grow tax-free until you die and leave it to your kids.
For private employer plans, we have a massive body of federal law called the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, or ERISA. This law governs private corporate retirement plans like 401k. It is vital to know who is not covered by ERISA. ERISA does not apply to state or local government plans, it's not applied to church plans, and it does not apply to individual IRAs. Furthermore, ERISA is enforced by the Department of Labor, not the SEC.
Under ERISA, if you are an advisor managing a 401k plan, you are legally designated as a fiduciary. And the standard of care is incredibly high. It is called the prudent expert standard. You aren't just expected to be careful, you are expected to act with the care, skill, prudence, and diligence that a seasoned professional expert would use in the exact same circumstances. Ignorance is not a defense.
Now, there is a specific ERISA safe harbor known as Section 404C. This is designed for participant-directed plans, like a standard 401k where the employee chooses their own funds. Think of it like a buffet. If the employer sets up a broad buffet of at least three core investment choices with varying risk levels and allows the employees to freely choose their own plate, the employer and the fiduciary are shielded from liability if the employee makes a terrible choice. If Dave puts 100% of his retirement money into a high-risk tech fund right before a crash, Dave cannot sue the employer for his losses.
However, and this is heavily tested caveat, the 404C safe harbor never shields the fiduciary from the duty to prudently select and continuously monitor the menu of options being offered on the buffet. If the fiduciary puts rancid meat on the buffet, meaning they include a mutual fund with exorbitant fees and 10 years of terrible performance, and Dave invests in it, the fiduciary is absolutely liable for a breach of duty. They failed to monitor the menu.
Take a deep breath. We are moving into Section 5, playing the market, strategy and trading. So, the accounts are open, the profiles are built, the business is structured. What is the actual academic philosophy driving how we invest their money? We start with capital market theory, specifically modern portfolio theory pioneered by Harry Markowitz.
Modern portfolio theory introduced the concept of the efficient frontier. Markowitz proved mathematically that risk isn't just about the individual volatility of a single stock. It's about how the stocks interact with each other. By combining assets that are not perfectly correlated, meaning they don't move in the exact same direction at the exact same time, you can actually reduce the overall risk of the portfolio without sacrificing return. An optimal portfolio sits right on the curve of the efficient frontier line, offering the absolute maximum possible expected return for that specific quantified level of risk. Any portfolio sitting below the line is inefficient. You are taking on too much risk for the return you are getting.
Then we have the capital asset pricing model, CAPM. CAPM builds on that and says that the market only compensates you for taking systematic risk, which we measure as beta. The market does not reward you for taking unsystematic, company-specific risk, because as we learned with Dave's 100 tech stocks, you could have easily diversified that away for free.
Yeah.
So CAPM uses a strict formula to determine exactly what return a specific security should logically provide based on its beta and the risk-free rate.
If you do the CAPM math, and it says a stock should return 8%, but the portfolio manager actually analyzes the company, buys the stock, and it returns 10%, that extra 2% above the CAPM prediction is called alpha. Alpha is the holy grail. It represents pure manager skill. It is value added beyond what the market passively offered.
But then we crash into the efficient market hypothesis, the EMH. This theory is a massive buzzkill for active traders. EMH argues that financial markets are incredibly efficient at processing information. It comes in three forms: weak, semi-strong, and strong. The semi-strong form, which is widely accepted in academia, states that all publicly available information, past price data, earnings reports, news articles, economic data, is instantly, perfectly, and accurately priced into the stock the moment it is released.
Therefore, under the semi-strong form of EMH, fundamental analysis is completely useless. All the hours cautious Kathy spends reading balance sheets and calculating the Gordon growth model are a waste of time because the massive institutional computers have already digested that information and adjusted the price before Kathy even finished her coffee. You cannot beat the market using public information.
Okay, hold on. If the efficient market hypothesis is true and the market is truly unbeatable, why does day trading Dave even bother? Why does anyone try to actively pick stocks? Why does an entire industry of hedge funds exist?
Because human nature inherently believes in the ability to find an edge. That is the eternal debate between active and passive management. Active managers fundamentally reject the strict forms of EMH. They believe the market is emotional, prone to panic and euphoria, and therefore contains temporary inefficiencies that they can exploit through research and timing to generate alpha. They believe their skill justifies their high fees and the higher tax burden of constant trading.
Passive managers, on the other hand, accept the efficient market hypothesis. They realize that after fees and taxes, almost no active manager beats the market consistently over a 10-year period. So instead of trying to beat the market, they just buy low-cost index funds that mirror the S&P 500, aiming to simply match the market's return as cheaply and tax-efficiently as possible.
Let's talk about the actual mechanics of how Dave places his trades. Order types. Dave is looking at a stock currently trading at $50. He wants to buy it, but he thinks it's a little overpriced. He only wants to buy it if it drops down to $45. So he enters a buy limit order at $45.
Or conversely, let's say Dave already owns a stock at $50. He is terrified of a sudden crash while he's asleep, so he wants to automatically sell the stock if it drops down to $45 to limit his losses. He enters a self-stop order at $45.
There is a vital classic memorization tool for order placement on the exam. Slobs over bliss. S-L-O-B-S over B-L-I-S-S. Sell limits and buy stops are always placed above the current market price. Buy limits and sell stops are always placed below the current market price. If Dave places a buy limit order at a price higher than the current market price, the broker will just instantly execute it at the current better price.
Let me ask you a direct question about mechanics. Think about the buy limit order Dave placed to buy at $45. Let's say bad news comes out, the stock drops, and the ticker tape shows it hit exactly $45. Is Dave's execution completely guaranteed? Did he definitely buy the stock? Take a second.
No, it is absolutely not guaranteed.
A limit order guarantees the price, but it does not guarantee the execution. There might be a massive line of 1,000 other buyers who placed their $45 limit orders before Dave did. The stock might touch $45 for a split second, fill a few of those earlier orders, and instantly bounce back up to $46. Dave gets nothing. A market order, on the other hand, guarantees immediate execution, but it does not guarantee the price. You just take whatever the next available price in the order book is.
And if Dave wants to turbocharge his returns by trading on margin, meaning borrowing money from his broker to buy more stock than he can actually afford, he has to abide by Regulation T, set by the Federal Reserve Board. Reg T requires a strict 50% initial margin deposit for equity trades. If Dave wants to buy $10,000 worth of Tesla stock, he must deposit at least $5,000 of his own cash. The broker lends him the other $5,000.
And once he owns the stock, he isn't entirely safe. The self-regulatory organizations require a minimum 25% maintenance margin as the stock fluctuates. If the stock crashes and Dave's equity drops below 25% of the total market value, he gets the dreaded margin call. He has to wire more cash immediately, or the broker will unilaterally liquidate his positions.
Let's look at how we measure the performance of these portfolios after a year of trading. We have two very different metrics that tell two different stories: time-weighted return and dollar-weighted return.
This is a classic comparison. Time-weighted return completely ignores the deposits and withdrawals made by the client. It calculates the geometric mean of the sub-periods. It only looks at how the underlying investments performed based on the manager's decisions. This is the legally required metric used to grade and advertise the portfolio manager. It answers the specific question: did the manager make good choices with whatever money they happen to have at any given time?
Dollar-weighted return, which is mathematically identical to the internal rate of return we discussed earlier, includes the profound impact of the client's actual cash flows. It grades the investor's actual lived experience. Let's say our portfolio manager is brilliant and the time-weighted return of the fund is a steady 10%. But Dave is an emotional wreck. He panics and withdraws all his money at the absolute bottom of a crash and then deposits a huge sum of money right at the peak of a bubble.
Because of Dave's terrible timing, his dollar-weighted return will be deeply negative, even though his manager's time-weighted return was a positive 10%. Dollar-weighted return is distorted by the size and timing of cash flows. The manager hates Dave's timing, but the manager's advertised track record isn't ruined by it because they report time-weighted returns.
We are entering Section 6, the rules of the game, the legal framework and ethics. This is where the exam gets ruthless, and it comprises a massive portion of the test. This is the Uniform Securities Act and the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. This is how we keep Dave, Frank, and our own advisory firm out of state prison.
It all starts with defining the board we are playing on. What actually is a security? The Supreme Court established the definition in a famous case involving orange groves, creating the Howey test. An investment is legally a security if it meets four strict criteria. It involves an investment of money in a common enterprise with the expectation of profits derived solely from the managerial efforts of others. If a product passes all four prongs, it is a security and must be heavily regulated. If it fails even one, it is not. This is exactly why variable annuities are securities. You rely on the fund manager's efforts, but fixed annuities are not. The insurance company just guarantees a rate.
So Frank wants to issue a security to raise money. We already talked about SEC registration, but he also has to register at the state level under the Blue Sky laws. The state administrator has three specific methods of registration available. First is registration by filing, sometimes called notification. This is basically a fast-track rubber stamp for massive, established, seasoned companies that have been trading for years. It becomes effective automatically when the federal registration becomes effective.
Second is registration by coordination. This is the workhorse of the industry. This is when Frank's company registers with the state administrator and the federal SEC simultaneously. The state registration coordinates to become effective at the exact same moment the SEC declares the federal registration effective.
The third method is registration by qualification. This is the most rigorous and grueling process. It is used almost exclusively for intrastate offerings, meaning Frank is selling securities only to residents of a single state, avoiding SEC jurisdiction entirely. Because the SEC isn't looking at it, the state administrator looks at absolutely everything. They scrutinize the business plan, the financials, the ads. And critically, a qualification registration only becomes effective when the administrator specifically affirmatively orders it to be effective. There is no automatic time trigger.
Now we get to the absolute biggest minefield on the exam, defining the players in the industry. The exam will try to trick you by mixing up the terminology. We have investment advisors, or IAs. We have investment advisor representatives, or IIRs. We have broker-dealers, or BDs. And we have agents.
Let's start with the IA, the investment advisor. Notice there is no R there. The IA is the firm itself. It is the corporate entity. The definition of an IA relies on the ABC test. A firm is an IA if they provide advice about securities as a regular business for compensation. If they do all three, they are investment advisor.
If a firm meets that ABC definition, they have to register to operate legally. But where do they register? Do they go to the state administrator or do they go to the federal SEC? The answer is entirely dictated by their size, specifically their assets under management, their AUM.
Pay close attention to these exact numerical thresholds. If the advisory firm manages less than $25 million in assets, they are a small advisor and they register at the state level only. Between $25 million and $100 million is the mid-size band. Generally, they still register at the state level, but once they hit $110 million in AUM, they cross a major threshold. They become a federal covered advisor and they must register with the SEC and deregister from the states.
Notice the gap in the numbers there. There is a buffer zone between $90 million and $110 million. Why? Because the stock market fluctuates daily. If an advisor is sitting right at $100 million and the market drops 10%, they are suddenly at $90 million. The regulators don't want firms having to constantly file expensive deregistration and re-registration paperwork every time the market has a bad week, so they provide a buffer. Once you hit $100 million, you may register with the SEC. Once you hit $110 million, you must register with the SEC. If you are SEC registered and your assets drop below $90 million, you must go back to the states.
Okay, that covers the firm, the IA. What about the humans working inside that firm, the investment advisor representatives, the IRRs? This is the human being sitting across the desk providing the financial plan. Here is the massive, heavily tested exam trap. Where do the human IRRs register?
An IR always registers at the state level, always. They file a Form U-4 with the state administrator. Even if the firm they work for is a massive, global, $10 billion SEC-registered federal covered advisor, the human IR still registers with the state administrator in any state where they maintain a physical place of business. The logic is simple. The SEC regulates the giant corporate entities, but the local state administrator regulates the human beings walking their streets and talking to their citizens.
Let's look at the other side of the industry wall. Broker-dealers. They don't charge fees for ongoing advice. They affect securities transactions. They act as an agent, matching buyers and sellers and charging a commission, or they act as a dealer, trading directly from their own inventory and charging a markup. The firm itself is a broker-dealer.
And the humans answering the phones and executing the trades for the broker-dealer are legally called agents. And here is another absolute undeniable rule. An agent is always an individual, a natural human person. A corporation cannot be an agent. An LLC cannot be an agent, only a human being with a pulse. Agents register with the state administrator via Form U-4, and their registration typically becomes effective at noon on the 30th day after filing, unless the administrator speeds it up.
Let's do a pattern interrupt here. A quick, punchy memory trick for criminal penalties under the Uniform Securities Act. If day trading Dave decides the rules don't apply to him, and he commits actual, willful, intentional securities fraud, he triggers the 553 rule.
The 553 rule, it's simple. There's a 5-year statute of limitations for the state to bring criminal charges. The maximum criminal fine for violating the act is $5,000. And the maximum prison sentence is 3 years in state lockup. 553.
For civil liability, the rules are different. Let's say Frank accidentally sells an unregistered security to cautious Kathy. He didn't mean to defraud her. He just made a clerical error. Kathy can sue in civil court to rescind the trade. She gets her original money back, plus the legal rate of interest, minus any dividend income she received along the way. The statute of limitations for a civil suit is the earlier of 3 years from the date of the sale, or 2 years from the discovery of the violation.
The overarching inescapable theme of this entire legal section is fiduciary duty. As an investment advisor, you are a fiduciary. This means you must put the client's interests absolutely above your own, and you must proactively disclose every single material conflict of interest. And critically, under the law, omission is fraud. Failing to tell a client something important, like the fact that you get a kickback for recommending a specific mutual fund, is treated exactly the same by a judge as actively, maliciously lying to them.
The primary vehicle you use to disclose all this vital information is through the Form ADV Part 2A, which is commonly referred to in the industry as the brochure. It is written in plain English. It tells the client exactly how you calculate your fees, what your conflicts of interest are, what your educational background is, and what your investment strategy entails. It must be delivered to the client either before or exactly at the time they sign the advisory contract.
Another massive ethical and regulatory tripwire is custody. Custody legally means having direct access to or control over client funds or securities. A lot of advisors think, I don't have custody, I don't hold their money in my basement, Charles Schwab holds it. But if you have the authorization in your contract to automatically deduct your quarterly advisory fees directly from the client's account, the state administrator says you legally have custody. Why? because theoretically, instead of deducting your $500 fee, you could maliciously deduct a $50,000 fee. You have access to their money.
And if you have custody, the regulatory burden gets heavy. You must use a qualified custodian, like a bank or an established broker-dealer, to hold the actual assets. You must ensure the client receives detailed quarterly statements directly from that custodian. And most importantly, you are subject to an annual surprise audit by an independent CPA. They show up at an irregular time, unannounced, to verify that the client's money is actually where you say it is.
We have arrived at the final hurdle, Section 7, the math. Calculations to know cold. We promised you wouldn't have to be a math genius to pass this test. The calculator's only used a few times. But the test writers are devious. They will give you a massive paragraph full of numbers, and only two of them are actually needed for the formula. The rest are pure red herrings designed to confuse you and make you doubt yourself. Let's do a rapid-fire breakdown of the core formula so you can spot the traps.
Let's start with total return. This is the most comprehensive metric. It captures everything an investment did over a holding period. The formula is ending value minus beginning value plus whatever income was received divided entirely by the beginning value.
The trap here is almost always related to bonds. They will tell you that Kathy bought a corporate bond for $900. It paid $50 in interest. She sold it a year later for $950, and the bond has a $1,000 par value. Ignore the par value. It means absolutely nothing for a historical total return calculation. You only care about the actual cash that left her pocket, the beginning value of $900, and the actual cash that came back into her pocket, the ending value of $950 plus the $50 income.
Next is current yield. This is a snapshot.
Mm-hmm.
Annual income divided by the current market price. Again, watch the bond language. If the question says a bond pays a 6% coupon and has a standard par value of $1,000, you have to do a micro step first. That means it pays $60 a year in annual cash income. If the current secondary market price of that bond is $800, the current yield is $60 divided by $800. You do not divide by the $1,000 par value. The market price dictates the current yield.
Real return. This is incredibly simple, but heavily tested in the context of inflation risk. Real return is simply your nominal return minus the inflation rate. If Dave's stock portfolio grew by 10% this year, his nominal return, but the consumer price index shows inflation was 4%, his real return, his actual tangible increase in purchasing power at the grocery store, is only 6%.
Finally, tax equivalent yield. This is the exact formula cautious Kathy uses when she is sitting at her kitchen table trying to decide between a tax-free municipal bond and a taxable corporate bond. She needs an apples-to-apples comparison to see which one actually puts more net money in her pocket after the IRS takes its cut. You take the municipal yield and divide it by the sum of 1 minus her marginal tax bracket.
Let's do the math on that so it sticks. Let's say a local municipal bond is paying a 4% tax-free yield. Kathy is highly successful. She is in the 20% tax bracket. To find the tax equivalent yield, you take 4% and divide it by 1 minus 0.20, which is 0.80. So 4 divided by 0.80 equals 5%. That 5% is the magic number. It means Kathy would need to find a fully taxable corporate bond paying more than 5% to actually beat the 4% she gets from the tax-free muni. If a corporate bond is only offering 4.5%, she buys the muni every single time.
Okay, we have covered an immense amount of ground. We have torn this cheat sheet apart. We are moving into the outro. It is time for the rapid fire recap. I am going to ping pong back and forth with the expert. We are firing off the absolute ultimate, highly testable takeaways from this entire deep dive. You need to hear these in your sleep. Ready? Go.
Human IRs, the representatives, always register at the state level with the Form U4. Never with the SEC, regardless of how massive their firm is.
The yield to worst is always the lowest possible yield. On a premium bond, because the ladder flips upside down, that means the yield to call.
The SEC absolutely never approves a security. They only declare the registration statement effective based on disclosure.
Dividends paid by a company are a financing activity on the cash flow statement, but dividends received by a company are an operating activity.
FDIC insurance protects your cash against a bank failure. It does absolutely nothing to protect you against secondary market losses on brokered CDs.
And naked call writing is the most dangerous strategy in existence because it carries an unlimited maximum potential loss.
Fantastic. Now, as we wrap up, I want to leave you with a final provocative thought, something we touched on briefly, but something that bears much deeper reflection if you are going to spend your career in this industry. We discussed the efficient market hypothesis. The strong form of this theory suggests that absolutely all information, both public news and completely private, illegal insider information, is already perfectly priced into the stock market at all times.
If that theory is actually true, than the entire multi-billion dollar active management industry, the flashy hedge funds, the mutual fund stock pickers, the guys on TV screaming about stock picks, is effectively selling a massive illusion. They are charging ordinary investors billions in fees for an informational edge that mathematically cannot exist.
So, the next time you look at a fund manager charging a 2% ongoing management fee and a 20% performance fee, ask yourself, are you truly paying for alpha, for genuine skill? Or are you just funding their marketing budget and paying for the privilege of underperforming a cheap index fund?
It is a profound question that every single fiduciary has to wrestle with when they build a portfolio for their client.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We have torn apart the cheat sheet, we have exposed the exam traps, and we have built the mechanical foundation you need to understand the why behind the rules. Go into that exam room, channel your inner expert, protect Kathy, rein in Dave, and absolutely crush it. Good luck.